Okay, it's working. Good morning, everyone. Boker Tov. Great to have everybody. It is an honor to conclude this Zman, Bli Ayin Hara, with our final shiur. Hakaras Hatov to Stanley Weisbrot for hosting, for sponsoring this morning. Thank you to all of our sponsors over the course of this Zman. And thank you to everybody for participating. We will, Im Yirtzeh Hashem, reconvene in Elul, and I'll share by email some of the details. We have been exploring the question of who is a Jew over the course of the entire year. So this morning is an epilogue to that issue. We began in 1958 with the Israeli government political crisis regarding the registration of children of intermarried couples, right? Of intermarried couples. So 4 years later, in 1962, this issue of who is a Jew came to the fore again, another time. Now, the person whose response to this issue we are going to explore today was not asked in 1958. In 1958, he was still single, not yet married. He was in Boston, in Harvard, in graduate school, pursuing his doctorate in literature. And he was not yet the Rosh Kollel of the Reef Kollel that he would subsequently lead, and also not yet the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Etzion, which he would later lead together with the late Rav Yura Mital, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. And this is Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Bekar Shiva. So Rav Aaron, in 1958, is still pursuing all of these things. In 1960, we spoke about this, how he got married after the Rav recovered from his illness, or after the Rav was being treated from his illness. 1962, we have a resurgence of the issue of who is a Jew. And Rav Lichtenstein addresses it in an article. Now, this article is now published now in the second volume of Leaves of Faith, so you can get it, it's available. The first part of the article deals with the immediate case that arose in 1962, which we'll talk about first. And the second part of the article reflects more broadly on the question of who is a Jew and brings us full circle to what we started with in the Hakdama and to what we've been dealing with until now. Glenn, why don't you jump right here next to Ira. You'll grab the chair. So the case that precipitated Rav Lichtenstein's article and the interesting discussion in 1962 is a court case that arrives at the Israel Supreme Court, which is decided by the five panel of judges by a 4-1 margin, surrounding a man whose nickname is Brother Daniel. That's what he goes by, Brother Daniel. That's how he's called. His real name, or his original name, I should say, was Shmuel Rufeisen. Polish. Shmuel, we'll explain it. Shmuel Rufeisen. His Polish name was Oswald. He was born in 1921 in a town called Zadzel or Zadzela. I don't know exactly how to pronounce it. And in November of 1941, he's 20 years old, he arrives in Mir. He arrives in Mir in this Polish town, bearing false identity papers, and he works as a translator in the local police station. Of course, what's going on in Mir in November of 1941? It's overrun by Germans.
Yeah. Oh.
He told, because he had access to all of this information in the ghetto, he told Jews when things were going to happen, when there are going to be roundups. And because of that, because he let people know, he was able to rescue, thanks to him, around 200 Jews escaped from the Mirror ghetto, went to the forest, and were saved by joining the partisans and hiding.
Probably could have saved more had they listened to him.
Well, okay, I'm not, I don't know.
But you know what I'm saying? A lot of people say it's not going to happen.
You have to look at every specific case. I have no idea if that was the case here, but it's very significant. And that after the liquidation of the ghetto, his real identity became known. He went into hiding. Where did he hide? Right near the police station was a monastery. So he goes into the monastery and he hides from August 1942 until December 1943 in this monastery while they're still looking for him. During his stay in the monastery, he decides to convert. He converts to Christianity, and at the end of 1943, as a Christian, he leaves the monastery and goes to the partisans in the forest. He joins the Russian partisans in the Nalaboki forest, and after the war, he joins a Carmelite order and becomes a Catholic priest, changing his name to Brother Daniel. In 1958, he emigrated to Israel and joined the Stella Maris Monastery on Mount Carmel. He's a Carmelite monk. And he gets there, and you see on the if you were here, you have the pictures. If you're online, you can hopefully see. This picture is the picture of him when he was in Poland. This is a picture later on. This picture is from 1993. He's sitting on the wall. You see, this is a gathering, a kennis. Kennis. Oh, you can't see it so well here. I'm going to pull it up on my computer. Maybe I could. Oh, I'm not going to do the share screen. I'll read you what it says. Hang on. Bruchim abayim. Welcome. Lekenes to the conference. Nitzolei Mir. Those who were saved from Mir. Baho kara rabah, with great thanks. Lematzilenu, to the man who saved us. Oswald, Shebizchuso Anukan, that in his merit we're here. That's what it says on the sign. May 22nd, 1991. This is 1991. So you see the man sitting with the small beard? That's Oswald Rufeisen. And who's speaking? Israel Shifran, one of the survivors. So this is a complicated parsha, because this man, who's responsible for saving 200 Jews, who comes to Israel, who says, I was born a Jew, I want to identify as a Jew, but now I'm a Carmelite monk. Can he receive zchuyot? Can he be accepted according to the law of return as a Jew? He dies in 1998 as an Israeli citizen, but not because of the Chuk HaShvut. The Israeli Supreme Court in 1962 rules that Brother Daniel cannot return as a Jew. Five judges, Silberg, Landau, Mani, and Berenson in the majority, Chaim Cohen dissenting in the minority, they ruled to reject his application and consider him not qualifying for the law of return as a Jew. He becomes a citizen through the laws of naturalization by residing in Israel, being part of Israel. Okay. But he's not a Jew according to the law of return. So everyone is up in arms. It's not so pashut, right? When you read the story just in a vacuum, you say, oh, a monk, he was born a Jew, he came to Israel, not so pashut. This is not Stam a monk. This is a man who his chaverim from Mir, the altar mirrors, to use a borrowed term, recognized him as one of their own, as being responsible for saving their lives. Now he comes to Israel, and the Supreme Court says, no, you're not Jewish.
They didn't give him any credit for that?
No.
No transfer credit?
No.
No.
They did not. So this becomes a controversy, and it stokes the flames of the whole issue that we've been talking about from 1958 of who is a Jew. Oh. So let's think about this, says Rav Lichtenstein. So the first part of the article, Rav Lichtenstein devotes to a halachic treatment of this issue. What happens to somebody who was Jewish and they vote out? They become part of another religion. In this case, they become Catholic. So in halacha, we have multiple categories that relate to such a person. In the Gemara, they're usually referred to as a mumar, and often in the Achronim and the Rishonim, in the later commentaries, they're referred to, this person is referred to as a mishumad. So either mumar or mishumad, we have different categories. We have a mumar who is ochel nevelos l'tayavon. They eat non-kosher food out of expediency, not because it's a principle. They went to the Dunkin' Donuts down the block, they see that it's closed. So they're too lazy to go to the new kosher Dunkin' Donuts down at Grosse Pointe. So instead, they stop at Burger King. That's ochel nevelos l'tayavon. If they had Dunkin' Donuts right there, they would eat for the kosher Dunkin' Donuts, but they eat from the treif because it's more convenient. Then you have mumar ochel nevelos l'hachis. God forbid a person deliberately, intentionally. Oh. Then you have mumar is l'chal Shabbos, God forbid, mumar l'avodah zar, mumar l'chal Torah kula, etc. All these categories. But Rav Lichtenstein points to another factor which needs to be taken into consideration here. And he says twice in the article that we have to be careful before we go applying it to specific cases, let's say to Brother Daniel. You have to know all the exact circumstances, and I don't know. You would have to really research and do the documentation. Rav Lichtenstein says there's another element here. And it's not just the element of the particular averos that the person does. He tells you a story that he heard from Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. The Maisa. The Rav told over this Maisa about his grandfather, Rav Chaim, that there was a man, he was an apostate, Rachmana Litzlan, a prominent Russian Jewish apostate, who was very active in governmental affairs. And the Jews in that area were, you know, they were in need of assistance all the time. So this person was having a particular milestone that was going to be noteworthy. It was going to be significant. So a group of Rabbanim were passing around a little letter to try to be mechazik and give him some kind of acknowledgement. Rav Chaim refused. Rav Chaim said, the person's a mishumid. They're a mishumid. There's no recognition. There's no birthday party. There's no engagement. Person's a mishumid. A couple of years later, there was a young Bundist Jew, anti-religious man, who also was in need of significant help. And Rav Chaim was very helpful. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I got the story wrong. It was before. So someone came to Rav Chaim and said, why are you not helping this politician, this mishumid? A couple of years ago, you helped this Bundist Jew a lot. You stuck your neck out for him. So Rav Chaim said, there's a difference between an avarian and a mishumid. An avarian is somebody who violates averus, a sinner. But a mishumid is somebody who in his entire personality becomes an apostate. They completely and totally abandon their Jewish identity. Rav Chaim said the mishumid, his children won't even know that they're Jewish. So Rav Lichtenstein discusses at length this issue of distinguishing between somebody who violates halachos, who is an avarian, versus somebody who's a mishumid, who adopts a foreign religion, where they totally transform their personality. And so he uses a Gemara Yevamos, where the Gemara says that there was a group of people, Kusoim and Shomron, Samaritans, who Chazal viewed them as completely not Jewish. How did they become completely not Jewish? Just because they assimilated. The answer is because their personality was transformed. So Wilkenstein goes back and forth between these two poles, between the sinner and the mishumid, in trying to determine whether or not somebody is a Jew. Once a Jew, always a Jew. Yisrael afal pi shechata Yisrael. Is that the case? Is that really true? That's what it sounds like from the Gemara. Well, yes, but no, exactly, until a certain point. Maybe Yisrael afal pi shechata Yisrael, even if he violated all the halachos, but at a certain point, his personality is transformed. Now, does that mean the person would totally lose all of their shame, Yisrael? Well, let's say that apostate, when they came back, would they have to convert?
In the beginning?
Yeah, would they have to go through conversion? Probably not. On the other hand, we say that that person, according to many opinions, would actually have to go to the mikvah. It's like a quasi-conversion. So it's this very complicated story, but yeah.
So when I was in Israel the first time, I was in a point of viewer. We had Ethiopian, we had also Hodu, we had people from India.
Yeah.
And it split right down the center, and it was about their practices and how far across. So from Ethiopia, they would just need to go to the mikvah.
Because they could be considered Jewish.
Right, but the village, the Indian village needed to go through because they were far enough away from the practices that they were no longer living a Jewish life.
They were not Jewish in their personality.
Right.
So this is exactly what Rav Lichtenstein starts sifting through in this article, which is fascinating. Because now what we talked about all year in terms of who is a Jew from a halachic standpoint, now when we're looking at it from the reverse, when somebody's trying to leave, how do we see that? At what point is it possible and can we consider them no longer Jewish? So according to the Supreme Court of Israel, this man, Brother Daniel, was not Jewish to qualify for the law of return. Would that mean he would need to convert when he came back? It's a good question. Probably not.
Why did he want to become Jewish again?
Because he viewed himself as Jewish. He viewed himself as a Jewish monk. He was born a Jew. He said he died a Jew. That was his tzava.
So why did he convert?
Because he felt that he could still add that to his identity. Now, Rav Lichtenstein points out that one of the challenges is that the nature of Christianity, and it's especially at its origins, was primarily exclusive. That it wasn't just a yes and, that it was a rejection of and an embrace of something new. A rejection of something else, an embrace of something new. Oh, okay. But then Rav Lichtenstein talks about the second half of the discussion, not the halachic part. And this is the part that I think for us helps us package and consider and wrap up so much of what we've talked about all year.
Just a quick question.
Yes.
When he died, was he buried in a Jewish cemetery?
That's a great question. I don't know.
Was it resolved or not?
We can Google it.
Google.
We have to Google where he was buried in 1998.
Google on the brother
Daniel. So Rav Lichtenstein suggests, as is the traditional Brisker approach, Tzvei dinim, two aspects. Two dinim. There is a physical aspect of Judaism, and there is a spiritual character of Judaism. There is the nature of being part of the Jewish community from a practical. Well, where was he buried?
Brother Daniel died in 1998 and was buried on Mount Carmel in the cemetery of the Stella Maris Monastery.
There you go. So he's buried as a non-Jew.
Is buried as a non-Jew in the monastery.
In the monastery.
As a non-Jew?
Yeah.
Yes.
I assume that's what he requested. Although maybe I shouldn't assume that. Maybe he asked. I don't know. You know what happens. You don't assume anything. Anyway.
There's my answer.
The point is, let's turn over the page to the second side. And Rav Lichtenstein, you know what? Actually, go back to the first side for a second. I'm going to get to that in 1 second. Rav Lichtenstein, before you get to the score, Rav Lichtenstein first points out that there is a physical connection among Jews, right? If we're trying to define the Jewish people, right? Who is a Jew? Well, one of those things now we're understanding is that person needs to be part of the Jewish people. They can't be a mishuma. They can't have voted out of the Jewish people as part of their identity. So he has a fascinating, amazing line. Here's the quote. It's not on your page. A distinct, what are we? We are a distinct socio-racial unit, divinely endowed with a religion, unique religion, and charged with a special historical function. The religion is confined to the group, and the group to the religion. So on a physical level, we're part of a group. We are individuals who are part of a group. And yet on the spiritual level, we also have a distinct nature. Take a look at this quote on the front here from this French philosopher, Ernest Renan. It's part of a conference that he led in 1882 on what is a nation. Rav Lichtenstein quotes this. Of course, I never heard of Ernest Renan, but Rav Lichtenstein knows who he is. A nation is a soul, a spiritual principle. Two things, which in truth are but one, constitute this soul or spiritual principle. One lies in the past, one in the present. One is the possession in common of a rich legacy of memories. The other is present-day consent, the desire to live together, the will to perpetuate the value of the heritage that one has received in an undivided core. So yes, there's one aspect of us which is physical as a people, but then there's the other aspect of us which is spiritual. And that spiritual dimension has two parts which are fused together. It has the past and the present. Part of the definition of us as a people, as a nation, is our connection to our past. It's our transcendent identity. This is something that we think about now. It's something that, if Mashiach doesn't come, unfortunately, I'm going to talk about next Sunday on Tisha B'Av, is the idea that there is a Knesset Yisrael, a spiritual entity that we are part of, which transcends time, which is much of what Tisha B'Av is about. We're recounting events that are different eras in history, but somehow they become woven into one narrative because we're not bound by time. The Jewish people are an entity that transcends time. We're part of something which is both the past and the present together. It's one. Right? That's what he's talking about. That's what Renan is talking about. And we see this in Halacha. Now turn the page. There's a Mishnah in Psachim, which is quoted by the Gemara in Menachos, and the Tosfos there makes an incredibly important observation. Who raises this Tosfos in our context? None other than the Gaon, the Chassid, Rabbi Nachum Zemba, Hashem Yikom Domo, Zchus Yagon Aleinu. Rabbi Nachum Zemba quotes this in a letter, in a tshuva, in a collection called Zera Avram. Rabbi Nachum Zemba, he was, you know, the Eloi of Praga, of the suburb of Warsaw, before he became one of the great spiritual giants of the Warsaw ghetto, running a clandestine network of underground sewer and bunker yeshivas. He was killed during the Warsaw ghetto uprising on Shabbos Chol HaMoed Pesach. So Rabbi Nachum Zemba has an essay in the Zera Avram where he talks about the nature of a tzibur in the context of a korban tzibur. He has an idea which is also talked about by many other Achronim. They emphasize the same thing. There's an article on the idea of a korban tzibur from a Rav in Gush by the name of Rav Danny Wolf. So in one of the footnotes, I heard this part from Rav Schechter from the name of Rav Soloveitchik, the Rav. In the footnote, Rabbi Danny Wolf says the same yesod appears in the Rogat Shavar and in Rav Amiel and others, and Rav Nachum Zemba quotes this Tosfos for the same yesod. The Gemara says here, Tanan, we have a Mishnah. If you shech the korban Pesach and you have chametz in your possession over below sase, there's a special iser, a special prohibition of lo sishchar al chametz dam zivchi. You're familiar with this, yeah. Right? Erev Pesach, you can't have chametz when you have shchitas Pesach. Reb Yura Omer af hatamid, also the korban tamid, says the Gemara, va'omer Reish Lakish. La'olam, in truth, eino chayev ad shiye o l'shochet o l'zorik o l'echad mibnei chabura ima bazara. Who is in violation of the iser of shchitas Pesach ala chametz? Only if you fall into one of the following three categories. If you are the shochet, the slaughterer, or the zorik, the person who splashes the blood on the mizbeach of the karban, or one of the members of the chabura, the people who own the carbon Pesach, echad mibnei chabura. But a random Jew, you know, Ploni Almoni, if somebody else shechts the carbon Pesach, you're not in violation of the iser of lo sishchar chametz dam zivchi. You have to be connected to that carbon Pesach. So look at Tosfos. Tosfos der dira maschal ola echad mibnei chabura. Zog Tosfos, a Pesach koi. This is talking about Pesach. Avol stame, pshita. Change gears on the side. The word stame is changed to tamid. The carbon tamid, of course, the carbon tamid is not going to be a problem for any random person, any random Jew. Wait a second. Who brings the carbon tamid? Or more precisely, when we say brings, whose money is used to pay for the Karban Tamid? Where do we look to? Where do we go to? Which fund is used to buy communal offerings? The Machzis HaShekel, the Truma Salishka, the fund which is collected from all the Jewish people. It's a Karban Tzibur. It's a communal offering, so it comes from communal funds. Well, that means who owns the Karban? All Jews. So why is it that Tosfos thinks it's obvious that the Karban Tamid? Oh, obviously, there's no way that every Jew who owns chametz on Erev Pesach is a violation when they shech the Karban Tamid shel Bein Arabayim. Why is that so obvious? Why is it so obvious? The Gemara even has, it's rejected. The Gemara had a Havamina in Renachos, one of the opinions out there, it's rejected, is that maybe Kohanim shouldn't give Machzis HaShekel because they are going to contribute to the Karban Tzibur, to the communal offerings, and some of the communal offerings are menachos which are eaten, and a Kohen is not allowed to eat a mincha that he brings. Minchas Kohen kol tiyaloseachel. So Gemara rejects that, but one of the interpretations in that, it's actually not everybody agrees with this, but it's the same principle. Ein Sham and Rashi. Rashi in two places deals with this issue. The answer is that there's a difference between a shutfus and a tzibur. What is a shutfus? And this is what Rav Menachem Emba develops, and this is what I heard from Rav Shechter in the name of Rav Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik L'Vrach. A shutfus is a partnership. So we can make a partnership with all of us, everybody in the shir, we each give money, we become partners. In a partnership, each one of us is identified as an owner. We are individual owners who have collective ownership. That collective ownership relates to every individual. That's different than a tzibur. A tzibur, Knesset Yisrael, the Jewish people as an entity, is not just, or primarily, a collection of individual people.
Much broader.
It's transcendent. Yeah. The sum is greater and different than its parts. We can have a shul with 1,000 people, 1,000 members, we're all shutfim. The Jewish people, as a together, we can get together, and this is what Rav Menachem Zemba is discussing, different kinds of gatherings of Jews. We can get all Jews together and make a collection, a fund for a particular thing. It'll just be a mammoth, enormous shutfus. Tzibur is different. Tzibur is the national identity which transcends time and place. It's not the same thing as a shutfus. And that's why Kohanim are allowed to give a machzis HaShekel. Because when you pay for something from the communal offerings, from the Truma Salishka, it's not the Kohanim are not shutfim. It's not a korban b'shutfus. It's a korban tzibur. Tzibur is not the same thing as shutfus. You understand that intuitively. That's the Rav's Chiddush. That's what the Gemara says in Horios, Ein Tzibur Meis. The community can never die because the community is a transcendent entity. The Ribbono Shel Olam made a covenant. With whom? So the Pasuk tells us. Says the Pasuk, in the end of Sefer Dvarim, it's not just with you that I'm creating a covenant. It's with those who are standing here. And the people who are not here. This is the context of the bris of Arvos Moav that creates Jewish interconnectedness. It creates arvus, kol Yisrael arevim zebozeh, right? It creates the concept of a tzibur to connect us to each other. The Pasuk says, it's with all the people who are standing there by arvus moav, and with all of us today, we're part of Knesset Yisrael. So that's why Rashi says, va'af im doros oasidim lios, even with future generations. That's us. Rashi says, we're part of this bris. How can you have a bris, a covenant, with people who are not there, who don't exist yet? Because the covenant wasn't with the group of individuals. It wasn't with a Shutfus. It was with a tzibur. With a tzibur. And that's the ultimate definition of the Jewish people. The issue of Brother Daniel, the issue of who is a Jew, part of it is about mitzvahs and averos and personal status, but part of it is about realizing that we are part of Knesset Yisrael. That there is a great soul, a neshama haklolis. That neshama haklolis, that collective soul, includes all sparks of the Ribbono Shel Olam of all time. That is the reflection of Hashem in this world, whatever that means. It's not about individuals. It's about this transcendent whole. It's that we, and it somehow, in a deep, mysterious way, collectively, over the course of time, reflect HaKadosh Baruch Hu, godliness in this world. That's a high level. To come to the end of the question of who is a Jew, it means many, many things. But especially in advance of Tisha B'Av, what we can take away is the recognition and the realization that we are part of a neshama hakolos of a Knesset Yisrael. And that shapes the way that we view life. It shapes the way that we view the state of Israel, which is where this whole thing got started. Is the state of Israel a nice place to vacation? Is it a nice place for Jews to get together? Is it a place of refuge? Or somehow is it another dimension of the neshama haklolis? Is it that we belong there because that's where our national homeland is? Or because our national homeland is there because there is a national identity that each one of us can connect to?
And I think it even puts it more in perspective coming out of the pandemic, coming together and as a tzibur coming in.
Exactly. But this is where sometimes we need to think bigger. And this argument, this orientation of the Knesset Yisrael helps us and challenges us, is that in Chutz La'aretz, we're broken. And so we don't have that feeling of neshama haklolis. And even if we have, like you said, coming back as a congregation, as a community, but a community in Skokie, in Chicago, in America, is not the full neshama haklolis.
It doesn't transcend.
Exactly. It doesn't have that other dimension of tzibur.
Right.
The only place you have a tzibur is in Eretz Yisrael. Yeah. That's why when you talk about the idea of a Sanhedrin, the idea of a Sanhedrin is both from a juridic standpoint, from adjudicating cases, but it's also from a representation standpoint, from a representative body that represents all of the Jewish people. Who do they represent? The Jews in Israel. Because Eretz Yisrael is the place where that neshama haklolis exists. We tap into it from here, and maybe that's part of our avoda. Part of what we're mourning on Tisha B'Av and part of what we're striving for is to wake ourselves up, to get out of the self-definition of, oh, I'm an individual Jew, I have a relationship with God. And even out of, I'm part of a community, I built the shul, the mikvah, the school, the kollel, all the important institutions, but to realize that we're part of something even larger.
And getting ourselves out of the loneliness.
That's right. And that's a big piece of what we are thinking about at this time.
Yeah.
To realize that our connection to Israel and our connection to history is through this lens of the neshama haklolis, of the tzibur. When we ask ourselves, who is a Jew? We can make a lot of observations, right? We've had a lot of perspectives. But ultimately, one of the key perspectives, one of the key things that we need to take away is that a Jew is part of the Jewish people. And that is a neshama haklolis. That is a transcendent entity. Oh. It's been an amazing